You're listening to the Monocle Weekly, first broadcast on the 21st of October 2012 on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Weekly is brought to you in association with Tourism Australia.
Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 172, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Sophie Grove.
Coming up on today's show, it's a bit of a literature special, starting with Steven Pinker, whose new book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, has just been shortlisted for the Samuel Johnson Prize.
We'll also meet British broadcaster Jonathan Dimbleby, who spent years reporting on conflict and has just published a new book on Churchill's 1942 victory in El Alamein.
And we'll speak to the Man Booker Prize chairman, Sir Peter Stoddart, on this year's competition and the future of books.
All that, plus we'll get next week's big stories and play some nice music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. It's Sunday, we've got bagels, we've got orange juice and a couple of flat whites. How are you doing, Sophie?
Great, I love all the delicious snacks.
I'm not entirely sure if we're allowed all this food and drink in the studio, but it doesn't matter. Tyler's away, so it's all fine. He's in Toronto, as is Andrew Tuck, where they have been...
gallivanting.
Yeah, having a party without us. I'm not quite sure what I think about this.
Well, we'll just have to vicariously enjoy the opening of the bureau.
Yes.
Down the ISDN line.
We had the fifth Monocle Bureau opened this week in Toronto. So we now have New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, Zurich and Toronto. Pretty good.
Pretty damn good. But, I mean, they sound like they had a really good knees up.
It was good. By all accounts, a knees up with champagne. But we've been holding the fort here and it's been most enjoyable, hasn't it?
It has. It's been great. Well, it's been industrious. We've been working very hard on the issue, which is looking rather good.
It is. This is the December-January issue, which is a beast of an issue, the biggest we do in the year. It's the soft power survey. So we now know, actually you and I now know, who's up and who's down, but we can't reveal that yet, can we?
No, it's top secret, but let's just say there's some surprises in there.
There are indeed. So we still have production week to look forward to next week, which I'm sure will be joyous. But other things will be happening next week, and Tom Edwards is here to tell us what they are. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Sophie.
Hi.
That was very elegantly done, Steve. I felt I need to point that out. You know, obviously everything you do has a little air of elegance about it, but sometimes I'm really, really particularly impressed.
Really? Oh, that's nice, particularly coming from you.
It's a touching moment.
Yeah, it really is.
I'm going to start with tomorrow. Why not? Let's kick
go on,
off
then. Yeah,
with,
yeah.
You know, the start of the week, and it's the last of three presidential debates.
Ooh, I'm looking forward to this one.
Well, it's really exciting. We're heading down to Boca Raton. The designated moderator this time is Bob Schieffer. You're the real sense of, you know, tension building. It's nicely balanced and sort of pretty unanimously declared verdict in Romney's favour for the first. Obama fared a great deal better in the second, all to play for. And I just think I always find it a compelling spectacle.
I have to say, I think the podium makes a big difference. Podium or high chair or stool, whatever they are sitting
high
on.
Chair, yes.
But it is a high chair. I think
Obama was
more...
clearly comfortable on that and Romney really wasn't,
You're
was he?
Absolutely right. And then the podium was a sort of Bauhaus kind of really sort of very, I don't know, it was a bit too big. It was a bit like a little kind of sort of capsule that they were sort of, I don't know, they didn't feel as accessible. I don't think Obama was comfortable in that aesthetic.
That's very interesting. Talking of aesthetics, very interesting, some speculation about whether they were coordinating their ties.
Oh, really?
One wore blue, one wore red first time round in party colours. They alternated the next time, apparently. Just a coincidence. So another thing to look out for tomorrow.
Do you think they'll talk about that beforehand? Do you reckon they call him Barack? I'm wearing the red. Is that all right?
They might do. And it's certainly one of the big issues for me.
I think the other big issue is, since it's on foreign policy, does Obama just go up there and say, I killed Bin Laden, and leave it at that? No? No, okay. Maybe not.
It's a strategy that will play well to large swathes of middle America. We know that for certain.
Okay, other than the debate, what else is happening next week?
I've got a real treat for you. The next day, Tuesday, it's the latest James Bond movie.
Is this your current affairs roundup?
Well, no, I like to throw in the odd cultural story as well. And inspired by arguable similarities to the Bond theme tune in our very own Monocle Weekly play-in, I thought I'd mention it. It's the world premiere at the Royal Albert Hall on Tuesday, and it marks the 50th anniversary of the Bond franchise. I think it's something we should be more proud of in this country.
I do too. It's such a soft power coup. I mean, really, it's something like one in two people on the globe have watched a Bond film at some point in their
lives. Incredible leverage.
And as you say,
talking about soft power, few things more effective, even though there's arguably not much that soft about this latest incarnation of James Bond 007.
Mm. He's gritty.
He's sometimes quite aggressive.
He is. He's a tough old nut.
Occasionally.
Isn't he?
Gets a little bit violent at times, doesn't he?
He does. But maybe we should see that more robust approach from our, you know, politicians, for example.
The neck snapping approach, you mean?
Well, I don't know. Imagine if Barack Obama just karate chopped Mitt Romney. He'd win that debate, hands down.
And then slept with his wife.
Exactly. That would be with a, you know, a martini on the side.
Shaken, not stirred.
There you go.
Yeah, there we are. Okay, so you've combined your first two stories. I was going to say news stories. Let's not suggest that the opening of a film is a news story. But you've combined your first two stories quite well there. After you've told us your third story, we're then going to see whether you combine all three.
Okay, I can just tell you right now that that's not going to be possible. We're going straight back to gritty international affairs. Very serious. There's really nothing funny about this one. South Korea and the US on Thursday are launching a new annual joint drill. The Hoguk exercise, involving Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps. A huge thing. Government officials, police will also be involved. Many US troops will join with their South Korean counterparts to improve joint operations. It's all aimed, obviously, at a bit of a muscle-flexing exercise for the attention of the North Koreans, fundamentally.
I can link them. It does actually sound a bit like the plot for an extremely exciting Bond movie.
All you
need is a kind of infiltrate, like some sort of pirate on the scene who's a double agent to infiltrate the entire military exercise.
You know, I was going to say exactly the same thing, and I thought, oh no, Sophie looks like she wants to speak. She's probably going to say something serious. I'll leave that.
Well, there you go. I think it's a whole kind of political action fest next week.
Excellent. Good. Tom Edwards.
On that bombshell, I'll leave you.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you very much indeed. We're going to be talking to Steven Pinker, author of a book all about violence and how, despite what Tom has just said, we're actually getting slightly less violent right after this. You're listening to Monocle Weekly. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Sophie Grove. Our first guest has given TED Talks, lectured at the School of Life, and is the author of six books. His most recent one, The Better Angels of Our Nature, has just been nominated for the Samuel Johnson Prize for Nonfiction, and argues that despite what we see on our screens, violence in society, be it murder or warfare, is actually in decline.
Steven Pinker has been on lists of top public intellectuals, most influential scientists and top global thinkers, and he joins us here in the studio now. Steven, hello.
Thank you. Hi.
Great to see you. Tell us, do you think we have become better, nicer, more gentler people as we've evolved, or over the last 100 years, for instance?
No, I don't think we have biologically evolved in the technical sense of a change in gene frequencies over the generations, because evolution has a speed limit measured in generations, and many of these declines have taken place too rapidly to be a product of Darwinian natural selection. And just as an example, the Germans used to be the world's most warlike people. Now they're probably the world's most pacifist, and that's happened in barely more than a generation. I think there are parts of human nature that have been with us all along. Some that tempt us toward violence, others that inhibit us from violence. And we've changed our institutions and norms to bring out the more peaceable parts, what I call, following Abraham Lincoln, the better angels of our nature.
Is it inevitable then that as we progress as societies, that violence declines, or you know, can that progress be overturned?
It most definitely not inevitable. It's something that we have to work at. And it can be overturned. There are a number of times in history that have obviously become more violent. The rise of genocidal dictators in the middle decades of the 20th century, the increase in the rate of violent crime in the Western world in the 1960s, growth in civil wars in the developing world following decolonization in the 1960s. And I talk about these reversals. The reversals themselves have been reversed, but definitely societies can become more violent.
Now, the book is out this month as a paperback. So, I mean, it's been several months since it first came out. Were you surprised at all by the reaction? Were there lots of people who said, God, this just doesn't sound right. Things don't feel like they're getting better.
I knew that at the outset, before I put pen to paper, so to speak, that it is a counterintuitive proposition, simply because if you get your impression of the state of the world from the news, you're going to be seeing whatever violence persists. That's what the news does. They cover things that happen. The news doesn't cover things that don't happen. And peace is something that doesn't happen. You never see a reporter standing in some city saying, well, it's now 37th year in a row and there hasn't been any war or genocide here. For similar reasons, if someone dies in a hospital bed of age-related disease, there isn't a camera crew at the foot of the bed. And we know that the human mind assesses risk and danger and probability by trying to recall examples. With the examples all too fresh from the news media, it's natural that people will think the world is more violent than it really is.
In the book, how do you sort of account for this sort of gradual shift in approaches to violence? I mean, corporal punishment and all these sort of social practices that have now changed. Do you think this is a sort of social evolution of thought, or what reasons do you give for it throughout the book?
Some of it is a change in institutions, like government. If you've got a disinterested third party that is reckoning and meting out justice, then you're less likely to have blood feuds and cycles of violence, which is what you would get if each side metes out justice that it thinks is warranted, because it's just in human nature. It's been documented by social psychologists that in every dispute, both sides think that the harm that they do is justified retaliation after the fact, and the harm that the other guy does is raw, naked aggression out of the blue. If you have both sides under the spell of these self-serving illusions, then each side always thinks there's still a score to settle. If you've got a third party making the decisions, then it's likely to be capped at one round of violence. I think institutions that foster trade and exchange and commerce make plunder less likely and knit people together in webs of interdependency that mean that attacking someone else is kind of like attacking yourself, because you need them to supply them with things you want or to buy stuff that you can provide them. That's why I don't think that the United States and China are going to go to war. They make all our stuff. We owe them too much money. It would be suicide for both. I think that that the advance of knowledge and the decrease of ignorance and superstition is another cause. If you know that stuff happens, that if there's a crop failure, it doesn't mean you've got to find a witch who cast a spell that made it happen. If everyone gets sick, you look for a germ instead of rounding up the Jews who you think poisoned the wells. If you know that Africans are no different than Europeans, you're not going to think that slavery is a natural institution. So the rise of knowledge and science helps. And the general spreading of ideas and people, cosmopolitanism, the reading about the lives of other people thanks to literacy and print, rubbing shoulders with them through travel, hearing their words, knowing some history, makes it harder to stay with your insular tribal values, and it makes it harder to dehumanize and to demonize a foreign people on the other side of the mountain range.
And when you've sort of come to the conclusion and written this book, did you feel, you know, did you sort of lose faith in human nature, in the sense that you felt that we are sort of barbarians repressing our natural sort of propensity for violence with civilization, or do you feel hopeful?
I have a modicum of hope. I do think that Homo sapiens is a nasty business. Our species has visited incalculable suffering on its own kind. But we've also figured out ways to bring the numbers down. We're never going to have a utopia. We're never going to eliminate violence. But if we reduce the murder rate to half and then half again and then half again one more time, it's almost an academic question whether we'll ever get it to zero.
And do you ever think that violence has a role in society? After reading this book, did you become a pacifist? Do you ever think, well, actually, you know, there is a role in some forms. Some people would argue there was, others really wouldn't.
I think the only role is to deter greater violence. I don't think the police should be shut down. I don't think the army should be dismantled. I think they should be reduced to the minimum size necessary, and their force should be applied strategically to be as light as possible in order to prevent greater violence. But we're always going to have psychopaths. We're going to have predators. We are going to need some way to take them out and to deter them. And in that regard, some modicum of violence, I suspect, will always be necessary. But not because violence is inherently, you know, heroic or manly or healthy or invigorating, all of those 19th century ideas. Violence is always bad, but sometimes a necessary evil in small doses.
Steven Pinker, thank you very much indeed. The book is The Better Angels of Our Nature. Best of luck with the Samuel Johnson Prize and with your lighter book on language. Not lighter, though, necessarily, is it? Just lighter in terms of subject matter.
And lighter physically. My publisher will not let me write another 800-page book.
This is a tome, a wonderful one.
Yeah, but the next book will be a book rather than a tome.
Excellent. Steven Pinker, thank you very much indeed. You're with the Monocle Weekly. That was Steven Pinker. I rather liked him.
Great hair.
Great hair. You know who he looked like?
Who?
Simon Rattle.
He did. It's absolutely like true.
Very uncanny.
Grey, wonderful curls. Let's just put it like that. That's the vision. He had a good head of hair.
He really did. He really did.
As well as a very, very large brain, clearly.
That's why you need so much hair to... Yeah, anyway. Now, I don't know whether you know this, Sophie, but... It's been our anniversary this week, as in Monocle 24's anniversary.
Wow, happy birthday, Steve.
Yes, happy birthday to you, Sophie, too. We are 1 year old. We've been celebrating it all this week. And one of the things we've been doing to celebrate is on Midori House, playing a track from a Midori House session all through this week. Every editor's got to choose one. What did you choose for yours?
Anna Bloom.
Ah,
I
like Anna Bloom.
Amazing. She's a Danish singer. She came into the Midori House Sessions room, studio, and had people virtually weeping with her lament.
She was wonderful. I chose James Yorkston, who was also beautiful as well. But I wasn't sure whether I wanted to choose him or Post-War Years. So because we are doing the weekly, we get a second bite of the cherry. So I am going to play Post-War Years, and this is Growl. We tried to... On campus. Thank you. That was Postwar Years with Grout from their Midori House session.
They were achingly cool. I think they came on a Tuesday morning. They looked like they'd been in an all-nighter.
They had, hadn't they? And then they invited us all out afterwards to, like, some gig. Like, hey, come tonight.
And I think a few people may have done, but it could have been a Tuesday night. When, and I think they were playing at sort of midnight or something. But they're very, I mean, they had a really interesting style. They sort of played to each other on these crazy sort of really ancient keyboards and sort of drum machines.
It was quite sweet, really. They all sort of played facing each other. Yeah, there we are. So that was Postwar Years. Up next, bit of a gear change, Jonathan Dimbleby. You're listening to The Michael Weekly.
When Sydney opera singer Adrian Tamburini isn't wowing audiences in his city's iconic opera house, he's outside enjoying its gorgeous surf beaches and magnificent harbour.
We have some incredible nature. Sydney, for example, is built around the water. There is water everywhere. There is sunshine. An outdoor kind of lifestyle is really important to us here in Sydney. And that reflects in the way we approach life.
There's nothing like Australia.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly with me, Sophie Grove and Steve Bloomfield. We're turning back the clocks. It's November 1942 and the Allied forces have just won a major battle at El Alamein. It's a victory that turned the tide in the North African campaign, preventing the Axis from taking control of the Suez Canal. And it's the subject of broadcast journalist and author Jonathan Dimbleby's new book, Destiny in the Desert.
Jonathan is part of a British journalism dynasty. His father, Richard, was the country's leading news broadcaster, and since the 1960s, both Jonathan and his brother, David, have been almost ever present on British TV screens. They're now two of the country's leading political journalists, both presenting the two biggest political debate shows. David has Question Time on BBC One, and Jonathan, as we love more than ever, because We're Radio, has Any Questions on Radio 4. Jonathan, welcome to The Monocle Weekly.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Thank you very much for coming in. Now, let's start with a quote, not from you, but from Churchill. Mm. This is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it is perhaps the end of the beginning. A quote that many people will recognise but won't necessarily know which battle to associate it with, and it is with the Destiny in the Desert.
Yep, he said that on the 10th of November after the victory at El Alamein, and it was a statement for him of huge relief that the battle had been won, although Montgomery, the general leading the Eighth Army into that battle, had said before the battle it is a mathematical certainty that we will win. It was also for him a statement of faith that now things really were changing. It wasn't so much the battle itself that changed the tide, but it was the culmination of a two-year fighting that changed the tide, along with the decision by the United States to come into the war in North Africa 4 days after the victory of El Alamein. The two together meant that Churchill had won a massive argument about the conduct of the Second World War.
I have to say, I was brought up with stories of the North African wars. My grandfather was there. He said the happiest day of his life was when the Americans joined the war over the birth of all his four children. But I wonder
I can't really believe that.
I wonder whether this really has a lot of resonance with modern audiences. I mean, we all know so much sort of hearsay about this battle, but do we know the details? Do we know the significance? Do you think it will really appeal to a sort of younger generation of readers?
Well, obviously, I hope so. What has been intriguing to me so far is that having started, because the book is only now published, but having been to one or two festivals and done some book signings, the numbers of people who've come up and said, my grandfather or my great uncle or my father was in that battle, in that conflict, because hundreds of thousands of British and Imperial forces, we must remember it was the Australians, the New Zealanders, the Indians and the South Africans, as well as the British on that battlefield, on the Allied side. The number of people who said, I want to read it because I want to know what happened. But the question was in my mind, why were we fighting here? And how important was it? Because I wanted to make sense of this battle in the context of the Second World War.
I'm intrigued at how you go about writing a book like this when so many of the participants are no longer with us. you know, do you, are there primary sources that you can rely on that aren't just official accounts from Whitehall, from Washington, from elsewhere? You know, are there journals that, you know, the ordinary people that were fighting there kept? Are there, were there still people alive who you could speak to?
The richness of material, if you are a journalist, I mean, I've written a number of books and they've included history, but I've generally written books about contemporary events. The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this chest, this immense booty of information, which is partly the official documents, the official reports from generals, governments, but it's largely the cables that were spent, that were sent in the heat of the moment, diaries, memoirs, letters. And that is a treasure trove because it tells you how people were really thinking. Because in those days, people who wrote their diaries didn't do so with the thought they're going to be published tomorrow, or an email that was going to be leaked, or the Freedom of Information Act would allow them, someone else, to acquire it. They were real diaries, real memories in the heat of the moment. So you've got that at the top level. The soldiers who fought on the ground, German soldiers, Italian soldiers, British, Australian soldiers, their memories were sometimes in the form of letters sent home through the censor, but nonetheless, you get a really good feel. And Rommel sent letters home to his wife, Lou, nearly every day, which are an incredible source of real feeling. They are available at the British Imperial War Museum, and books have been produced which are filled with, there's one which is called Forgotten Voices, which is the voices, the memories of those who were fighting on the battlefield. And they are extraordinary to read. Sometimes they're very funny. Sometimes they're excoriating. Sometimes they are very painful, but they are illuminating. Those were my principal sources.
And what did you make of the leaders at this time? I mean, they're fascinating characters, and some of them sort of have so much sort of mythology around them, like Churchill, but Monty, Rommel, who was actually popular across the ranks. People thought he was rather marvellous. I wonder, did you get a sense of who they really were when you were doing your research?
Yes, and I hope it comes across in the book. People who've read it say that it does. Auchinleck, who was Montgomery's predecessor, who was sacked ruthlessly by Churchill, was a very brilliant general. He actually stopped Rommel reaching the gates of Cairo, and therefore saving Egypt, which meant saving the British Empire. And for Churchill and for the British Empire was everything. You couldn't separate Britain from its empire. And the Middle East was the hugely important artery between Britain, its possessions in Africa, India, and the Far East. So it was an empire war for the British, still the biggest empire in the world. So Auchinleck, facing Rommel when he comes to power, sends a memo to his senior officer saying, we must get over the idea that Rommel is a superman. He is just an ordinary general, which, of course, indicated very clearly that he was seen by everyone as a superman. And Churchill even, to the astonishment and dismay of some, in the House of Commons said, if I may say, I'm not quoting him exactly, if I may say, across the havoc of war, Rommel is a very great general and I salute him. I mean, you think, excuse me, he's meant to be the enemy representing Nazism. And he was a man of great guile. He was an inspired leader. He took terrible risks and sometimes they terribly backfired. He was very focused. He used his forces very flexibly, but he understood how you drive through the enemy by pinpointing one area and boom, going straight through the other side. Montgomery, very different character altogether, very cautious, rather plodding, very ruthless, saying before El Alamein, we will have 13,500 casualties, which is almost exactly the number of casualties there were. Very disagreeable as a person. Churchill said, when appointing him in a letter to his wife, Clemmy, Churchill wrote, if he is disagreeable to those about him, he will also be disagreeable to the enemy. And he badmouthed his predecessor, libelling him unmercifully so that after the war, his publishers of his memoirs had to remove the offending passages by suggesting falsely that Auchinleck was waiting to retreat even further than El Alamein and to give up Egypt. It was a nonsense lie. Auchinleck Auchinleck kept his counsel about that. In fact, Auchinleck was waiting to do exactly what Montgomery then did, which was like a First World War battle. And Rommel fought tenaciously, but his forces were hugely inferior by that time to Montgomery's, to the British, and Montgomery was bound to win in the end. It was a very hard-fought and very bloody battle.
While we have you here, we wanted to just ask you a little bit about your views on journalism and broadcasting right now. This is now your fifth decade?
Goodness, I suppose it must be. Am I still alive? Yes, I think I am. I started in the early 1970s.
Okay. Fourth-ish. Well, let's not do the maths.
I'm just about starting the fifth.
Okay. We'll call it the fifth then.
Why don't you call it the fourth?
Obviously, quite a lot has changed over that period. Do you... Let's talk about the pessimistic side first.
Okay.
What are the things about where journalism is today that worry you?
Well, I would say twofold. One is a great paradox, that we now have means of communication that far exceed what was available when I first started reporting, even in 40 years ago. There were no mobile phones, obviously. You didn't use computers. If you wanted to make a call, I did a lot of reporting from developing countries and from places of crisis. You had to book your call to London, and you used something called a telex to send your messages. You were in an environment where it was very difficult to work very often because dictators ruled. Today, we have a fantastic means of communication, but it seems to me that, ironically and paradoxically, we are less curious about the rest of the world, in particular countries, than we were then. We have become more provincial, more local, more inward-looking. Listen to the radio, watch the television, read the newspapers, except at moments of acute drama in relation to, for instance, Syria at the moment, or an American election. Libya has virtually disappeared from the newspapers. A very major political drama is continuing in Libya, but it only surfaces occasionally.
Yes, but I mean, so in the 70s, though, would that have been a big story? If there'd been a revolution in Libya and then a year or so later, would people still have correspondents there? Would they still be reporting from there?
Well, there were more correspondents. I mean, there were more correspondents in these places and more freelancers working, not more freelancers working there, but more correspondents getting their stuff into newspapers and on air than now. But that is not quite my point. My point is that with the explosion of potential, we're doing it less rather than more in a sustained way.
Okay, you've done pessimism. Let's briefly do optimism. When you look at the state of broadcasting and media in general, whether that's in the UK or around the world, what are the things that make you excited?
Well, I tell you this: when I used to think it wouldn't be like this because everything is so much quicker now. When you look back, if I look back, I perish the thought. I do very occasionally, usually because I've got to get something out. I look back at a film that I or others have made 20, 30 years ago. They are virtually unbroadcastable today because they're okay. I mean, if you take something really great like The World at War, you can see that again and again, and people do see it again and again. Or my father doing the 1955 general election, which surfaces on our Parliament channel. You know, people watch that and say, wow, I watched your dad in 1955. That's terrific sort of historical stuff, but actually the quality, partly because of the technical resource that we now have, the capacity to do things, means that we can be much more imaginative in very ordinary programmes. And in fact, I used to be frightened, as it were, when there were only two channels, three channels, of what would happen once there was the explosion. I think it's fantastic that you now have a huge range of programmes that you can watch, and people can choose more or less freely what they want to watch, from the best to the worst.
Jonathan Dimbleby, thank you very much indeed. The book is Destiny in the Desert, The Road to El Alamein, The Battle That Turned the Tide. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour, quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Sophie Grove, and Steve Bloomfield. Before we meet our last guest of the programme, it's time for another musical interlude, Steve.
What do you have for us, Sophie? You're not choosing a Midori House session, are you?
No, well, I'm not, because I'm going to give them a rest, and I really want to pick up on the great launch of the new Bond film, which is happening this week, by playing one of the greatest Bond tracks of all time.
Really?
Which is...
Oh, hang on, let me guess. Is it Carly Simon?
No. That is Hugo McDonald, our design editor's absolute choice. And I have to really apologise to our listeners. He has played it many times on this station. But this is a track by Paul McCartney and Wings. And it was Live and Let Die. It's a bit of a bonanza.
It really is.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live. But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say, live and let die.
So that was Live and Let Die, Paul McCartney, Wings.
Yeah, don't forget Wings.
Wings are a sort of collaborative act. I just like to add, he didn't have wings at the time, strapped on.
Paul McCartney and his wings.
But isn't that fantastic? It really just, they let rip. They just went for it.
They really did. They did indeed. We're going to, again, slight gear change. From Paul McCartney, we're going to, well, another Sir, in fact. So Peter Stoddard in the studio right after this. The Man Booker Prize for Fiction has been awarded annually since 1969, and many of the works that have won seem to have become modern-day classics. The English Patient, The Blind Assassin, Life of Pi. This year's prize was awarded on Tuesday to Hilary Mantel for her novel Bring Up the Bodies, the first woman to win the prize twice.
But what impact does such a major prize, such as the Man Booker, have on an author's career? How can they capitalise on their success? To find out how these prizes play into the industry, we have in the studio Sir Peter Stoddart, editor of the Times Literary Supplement and chairman of the Man Booker Judges. Welcome.
Hi, good to be here.
So you must have been very busy reading the long list, the short list, that all over. Then the party. So it's all over.
Yeah, it was 145 books in 11 months. I think probably the bit where they were sort of literally falling off the bedside table was around about June. Since then, shortlists and longlists are a lot easier to deal with.
They are indeed. We had one of your fellow judges, Amanda Foreman, in here a few weeks ago, who was talking to us about the process of judging and in a way how formal it all is, in that you have these proper meetings with people taking minutes and notes. And what was particularly interesting was how she said that you'd all met beforehand to decide how you would judge it, and that no one could simply say, I really like this book. You had to go, obviously, a lot deeper than that.
Yes, well, I mean, the chairman, I think, has some control over how the process is done. But it's always seemed to me that the literary criticism is a set of arguments just like anything else. And it gets into trouble, these judging committees, if everybody is just pitting their own likes and dislikes against each other. I mean, if people can just say, I like it, I hate it, it reminded me of my sister and I hate her, you know, my children probably would have had a really good fun with this book, or I had a really lousy time, then it's all personal. It's just all opinion. I mean, the web is just full of that kind of stuff, masked as literary criticism. But it's really just taste dressed up, not even sometimes very dressed up. If you've got five separate tastes and they're different, and then there's no way of resolving it. I mean, it's just a question of who shouts the loudest. And some judging panels, I'm afraid, get a bit like that.
Did you find that when judging these books, obviously you're having to read so many so quickly, that it was often actually weeks later you would think back to, oh, that book that we read, several weeks ago, actually it's still with me, I'm still thinking about that, maybe I was a little bit hasty in my judgment, maybe I think we should talk about that again?
Yes, we did that, and we didn't have to produce the long list, which is the main cutoff, if you like. That's where you choose 12 out of 145 until three quarters of the way through the process. So we have plenty of time, yeah, for books to think, you know, where you think, yeah, I put that on my sort of possibles pile. But I mean, there are books that didn't make the shortlist, didn't make the long list, that are still very powerfully stuck in my mind. It's perfectly possible. I mean, there was some great books that perhaps had one really serious flaw, which would have kept them off the list. They weren't perfect. They were perhaps, you know, the writers were perhaps young. I hadn't quite got there. But nonetheless, they were. I'm not never going to forget them.
And Hilary Mantel was very, she was very magnanimous when she accepted the award. But she said, you know, two awards come along at once when you've been waiting for years, writing, for decades. Do you think that her career is really going to be shaped by this second award? And how do you think it will change the trajectory of where she's going?
It's a well-deserved double accolade for Hilary Mantel. I mean, there are some writers, you see them in radio studios all the time, you know, who are very good at promoting their own work, you know, and they're not always the best writers, I'm afraid. I mean, they're the guys who will come and talk to you at the BBC and to everybody else and, you know, are famous, and there are other people who prefer to sit in their studios and don't get out much. And I think it'd be fair to say that Hilary's life was perhaps very unlike the kind of media life of a lot of famous men writers of her generation. She didn't get a lot of recognition. She was a writer's writer, if you like. Everyone knew how good she was, but she did so many different things in so many different ways. That she was rather a bit late before she was really fully recognised, and it is true. So the fact that she gets this book, this prize, twice in very quick succession, you know, is in my view a vindication of a rather unusual and perhaps a rather more meritorious life of a great writer. But the prize was awarded for this book and this book only.
And at what stage in judging this did you think yourself, I think this is the winner, or I would like to see this as the winner?
No, we never discussed that. I banned the discussion of that.
In your own mind, surely when reading them you think, well, okay, these are my likely contenders.
No, I didn't. It's very important not to do that. Essentially, ranking books in by numbers or choosing winners and losers is a very unliterary, it's a very uncritical process. So the whole point, I think, is to delay it as long as possible. So each book you keep in your mind a description of its strengths and weaknesses. But I try very hard and was very... So if any one of the judges said early on, I really think this is going to be the winner, I've heard that that's happened before. That was sort of out of order. No one did that. And it's very important, I think, that you don't.
You sound like a bit of a reluctant judge in a way, that the award system being a kind of blunt instrument, if you compare it to something like the TLS that you edit, you know, it's so much more nuanced and that the sort of criticism is more considered, perhaps.
I just think the point is to postpone the business of ranking and as long as possible. one's view of a text of writing is a mixture of one's knowledge, sensibility, how you hear it, how you see it, how you feel it, how you can argue the case for it. And that doesn't resolve itself into numbers easily. And to pretend that it does is a pretense. But at the end of the day, you've got three books like we had on Tuesday, perhaps, you know, three or four books that were, and everybody could hear the arguments for them. And even the people who were advancing arguments for different books could hear and feel that there was stronger arguments for Hilary Mantel's Bring Up the Bodies than there were for perhaps the book that they favoured most. If you do it like that, you get good temper and good judgment, I think. And the smallest ranking and the least reduction to numbers. Numbers don't help here much.
It's almost, you know, counterintuitive then to say there should be book prizes, there should be literary prizes. I mean, as you say, you know, it's books unlike records, for example, music. You know, you don't get 5-star reviews. You know, there's an actual review. No one says, and I give this, you know, 8 out of 10.
Well, unfortunately, these days you do. I'm afraid that's the trouble. There's been a considerable corrupting influence on in the media. I'm afraid to quite a high degree, driven by online reviews, online opinion, which pretends that opinion, you know, sticking out your hand and saying I give it 5 stars. Or whatever, is the same as literary criticism. And indeed, if you suggest, as I have done occasionally this year, that some difference, and actually that some people's opinions are worth more than others because they're argued and because they're based on knowledge and sensibility and training, you get shouted down, particularly online, by people saying, "You mean you're saying your view is more valuable than mine?" I say, "Well, it's possible, surely." And they say, "Oh, that's absolutely outrageous! How can that possibly be?" Very strange. I mean, no one ever says that an untrained electrician is, you know, it's better than a trained electrician or an untrained doctor. But it's a curious idea has got around that when literary criticism is just everybody's view is absolutely equal. Right? But it's not good for literature, and it's not good for the judging of books. And the Man Booker Prize is set against that, and I think that's one of its strengths.
Where do you see the role of the sort of expert critic going in the future? I mean, you just talked about this kind of vitriolic, you know, everyman critic that's rolling around, you know, at social media. Do you think that we are sort of going to another era where there perhaps won't be the kind of venerated critic figure?
I love the fact that people are talking about books. I mean, I love these sort of online book clubs. I think that's really wonderful. It shows that people are reading. People are reading a lot. They're swapping opinions just as they used to, you know, over dinners and over, you know, in bars. And that's really great. I'd rather people talked about books in bars than just about football the whole time. You know, I mean, there's nothing. The only problem with it is if you pretend that it's criticism. Sport isn't a bad example, really, because curiously, everybody who talks about sport, about which I know nothing, I mean, always sound as though they believe they know exactly as much as the manager or whoever it is managing the team. That's part of the conceit. It's part of the lie, really, because, you know...
Oh, no, we do.
Yeah, exactly. But it makes everybody feel, you know, equal, which is great. And if you're asking people to pay £100 a day to go to see their favourite team, it makes them feel good that they feel they know as much. I don't suppose it does any harm to sport either. I mean, it doesn't. Unfortunately, there are sometimes, if you pretend that everybody's view is the same as everybody else, it can do harm. And I love the fact that everybody's talking, but I just do think there's a role for criticism, particularly when you're... I mean, this year on the Man Booker list, we found there were 3 books on the shortlist that, frankly, I don't think anybody would have seen in a big bookshop had we not found them.
And from tiny publishers as well.
Tiny publishers. These are books that I think would have sunk without trace unless critics had had the confidence and the knowledge to find them and to place them where they should be. You notice in certain kinds of prizes around the world, which are heavily dominated by the industry, perhaps or by the publishers or by the big names, that they just basically share the prize out amongst the big names. The judges don't really have to read all the books because they're sifted by junior researchers who just basically give them the big names. And the whole thing doesn't have any credibility. It's rather pointless. And it's also a bit of a closed shop against new talent, whereas the beauty of the Man Booker Prize is that you do get these judges who are prepared to read 145 books and to identify stuff that quite, you know, on the basis of their own knowledge and sensibility that others easily might not.
We had Jonathan Dimbleby in here a little bit earlier, and amongst other things, we were talking about the state of the media now. As you know, he's someone who's been involved in media for many decades, as have yourself. And he said that he found this strange paradox that although it was easier to communicate now than ever before, and that it was, you know, you could be in the middle of a desert and report on something and send it instantly, he felt that there was less space and less opportunity and less people really listening now to what was going on outside their own lives and their own world than there would have been 20, 30, 40 years ago. Is that a view that you share?
Well, he's obviously worked in a protected industry, which where you had, you know, a small number of TV channels. Everybody had to watch them, and they had they were the only place where you could put any advertising, and so they produced hours and hours of, you know, documentaries and that probably wouldn't have been produced if the market had been more free.
So he doesn't realise how lucky he had.
Yeah, exactly. In many ways, you're interviewing me at greater length now than you would ever be interviewed at the you know, on the BBC these days, and that's because the market has been completely turned upside down, and it's very good that we can have this lengthy conversation, as I'm sure. Sure, he enjoyed it too. The press, pretty much the same. If you were, when I started in newspapers, the Sunday Times Colour magazine was, for instance, was very new. It was the only place you could place colour advertising. So colour advertising was very expensive, paid a lot of people very big salaries to write very long pieces from very exotic places far away. And if they didn't work out and they were canned, nobody cared very much. That was one that was very good for top journalists.
Sounds bliss.
Yeah. Absolute bliss. Of course, it was very difficult for you to get in, though, because there wasn't much opportunity to do it. Now, almost anybody can do it. You hardly anybody who can't write something and put it up on the web or put it out somewhere, but they don't get paid and they don't get, and it's difficult to find it, people, an audience. And that is a change. I mean, nothing's going to turn the clock back on that, I don't think.
Peter Stossard, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for coming in. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. So it's been a bit of a literary show, hasn't it, Soph?
It has. I mean, Sir Peter is fantastic. The fact he read 145 books seemed to him completely normal, can I just say?
Yeah, it's really not.
That's the type of guy he is. I don't know whether it's something that we really have time for. It's just normal editors on a quite, literary, but I think the TLS really is a benchmark, isn't it?
It is. But, you know, I think it's, they're paid to be judges as well. It's a job, not necessarily a full-time job if you do it over a long enough period of time, but, you know.
You'd have to get a really comfortable chair. A
you
lovely
would.
Angle poise lamp, possibly a log fire.
Yes, and I like the idea that you could say to your partner, don't interrupt me, I'm reading, it's for work.
Yes, it would be helpful, because actually, reading is quite antisocial and selfish. I can't say that.
Oh, you can, and you just did. On that note, on that wonderful note, we're going to leave it right there. That's all for this 172nd edition of the Monocle Weekly. Don't forget that all our shows, like this one, can still be downloaded from iTunes or monocle.com. The show today was produced by David Michon. Thank you very much, David. It was studio managed by Alex Funnell. Thank you very much, Alex. And it was researched, as ever, by Tom Hall. Thank you very much, Tom. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And me, Sophie Grove, lover of books. Goodbye.
Goodbye.